This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporter Roundtable Thursday. We'll chat today with a couple reporters from the Times about the stories that they've put out online and in print. Giles Bruce will be with us, as well as education reporter Carmen McCollum. And a little later, an extended conversation with State Senator Ed Charbonneau about water infrastructure issues. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday, it's time to take a look at health and healthcare news here in Northwest Indiana. And for that, we are turning to Giles Bruce. He covers these topics for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Giles, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's start in here talking about some women's surgery issues and how Northwest Indiana seems to have made it in a prominent journal.
Yeah, I recently met a Northwest Indiana woman named Julie Wise, who was struggling with blood clots for a number of years, but she finally met a physician in Northwest Indiana, Dr. Safadi, Dr. Anas Safadi. He's with St. Mary Medical Center in Hobart, and he diagnosed her with a condition called deep vein thrombosis, which is a fairly common condition, but she apparently had a very severe form of it, so it was really having some problems and, you know, a lot of pain and not even able to get out of bed, hardly. But, yeah, he eventually referred her to Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, where the surgeons were perplexed by her condition. It was so, so severe and kind of out of the norm. So they had to basically invent a new kind of surgery on the spot, where they went in through, different parts of her body to get at the blood clot. And since it was so unique, it ended up being written about, her story ended up being written about in a medical journal, and that article was published recently.
Dr. Osman Ahmed, I understand, is the radiologist at Rush who did the surgery, and he called it the shotgun technique. I wonder how he came up with that idea.
I'm not exactly sure the origin of the name, but, I think it was because they, had to puncture her vein in a few different spots, kind of like just a gunshot, taking shots and going in there and getting into the blood clot and what they needed to do. And, so it ended up being a unique surgery. It ended up solving her problems, and she's able to walk, without pain and do daily activities again. So it had a happy ending.
I was going to ask how she's doing and recovering from her surgery. And I wonder how long it basically took for her to try to get back to, or she's trying probably now to get back to normal.
Yeah. She's still out of work. But she is, on the mend. Like I said, she can walk again without discomfort. She doesn't have any more pain in her legs. So, this gunshot technique, as they called it, seems to have worked.
And one of the other stories that I know that you covered for the Times of Northwest Indiana here is following up on a Munster physician who has been, in trouble before because of dealing with his patients, and he's already been to trial once, and I guess he's facing another civil court trial very soon.
Yeah, Dr. Arvind Gandhi was a cardiologist in Munster. He retired in 2015, but before that he started having some medical malpractice complaints filed against him. People in the community were claiming that he did surgeries that they didn't need, that weren't necessary, and there are now up to roughly 300 people who have filed these complaints against him. The first case went to trial late last month and ended earlier this month, and he actually, the jury came out in his favor. So he actually won the first trial. There was no fine or anything against him. So, the next trial that's lined up is scheduled to start April 9th, of a woman who went to see him for low blood pressure, kidney stone, some other conditions, and You know, he ended up, having her defibrillator replaced, and she claims that that wasn't necessary and led to some problems for her down the road.
I understand, too, that besides Dr. Gandhi and his former practice, I understand that the community hospital in Munster is also part of this lawsuit. Apparently, are they named, as best you can tell, in all of the suits that have been filed against this doctor?
Yeah, they have been named, and they were named in this lawsuit. The plaintiffs are claiming that the hospital was negligent, that they knew that he wasn't certified to be performing these kind of procedures. He was a cardiologist rather than a electrophysiologist, which the plaintiffs were claiming was the type of doctor that should have been doing these procedures, and they were saying that the hospital was negligent in letting him do it.
I understand in Indiana that it's a certain procedure that has to be gone through if there's a complaint filed. I guess it was in the case of all of these complaints against Dr. Don Gandhi here that I guess has to be dealt with first on the statewide level. How does the state deal with these medical malpractice claims? And then how did Dr. Gandhi end up find himself in being sued in court now?
Yeah, in Indiana, medical malpractice claims have to be filed with the Indiana Department of Insurance. They then go before a three-person medical review panel, which is made up of three physicians, of the doctor's peers, who review the case and decide whether it has any merit. Once they make that decision, then only then can the case go to trial. And in the case of the first trial against Dr. Gandhi and this case as well, the medical review panel unanimously ruled against him. They ruled that he did perform the procedures unnecessarily.
We're talking with Giles Bruce, who covers health and healthcare news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And I understand, Giles, one of the other stories that you covered this time around was taking a look at the latest data that comes out from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the county health rankings. And tell us how Northwest Indiana County seemed to fare on that report.
Yeah, this is a report that comes out every year, analyzing the health of the counties across the United States. And, in Northwest Indiana, we don't do so hot. In the latest rankings, I'm pulling it up here, but Lake County is in the 70s, LaPorte County is down there as well. Porter County is actually number 20, so they do a little better. Some of the things that all the counties struggle with are, high rates of obesity and smoking. The reason Porter County does a little better, they do better in some of the socioeconomic areas, such as children in poverty and high school graduation rates. So that's the reason that they fare better.
Mm-hmm.
But in the latest rankings, Lake County was 74th out of the 92 counties, and LaPorte County was 69th.
Now, what kind of response did you get in talking with folks who deal with the cases in the counties in Lake and Porter and LaPorte counties? What's their reaction to how the standings turned out in the report?
I'm not sure people are very surprised. They know that Northwest Indiana has some work to do with these health measures, but they were, they did tell me about some of the things that they are doing, such as increasing access to healthy foods in communities like Gary with, farmers markets, efforts like completing more trails in the counties so that people can bike and walk more. So they're making improvements to the built environment and access to opportunities to do physical activity that they hope will turn these numbers around.
I know that occasionally, Giles, that you not only get to follow through on your usual beat on the health issues of the region, but also you do some breaking news as well, too, to cover for the Times here. And recently you got a chance to follow through on, I guess, what turned out to be a very sad situation with a fire at an apartment building in Gary. Tell us about what you found out about all of this from the people you talked to for your story.
Yeah, well, I stopped by Majestic Star Hotel on Monday where the families are staying after they were displaced by the fire. There are about 40 families there, many of them with kids, who had to stay in the hotel for a couple of days. And they described a pretty scary scene, heavy clouds of smoke in the apartment and, just a chaotic scene. And, one of the women I talked to had talked about how she, she got out and she heard this young boy, screaming for help from his fourth floor apartment. She couldn't get back up all the way to the fourth floor because the smoke was so heavy, but she, went and got a blanket out of her apartment that ended up being, one of the blankets that the people held out and the 8-year-old boy jumped into to his safety. So it was a chaotic scene, but, people came together to help out and try to, save some people who are in distress.
Now, in cases like this, Giles, when you have situations where a lot of people, in this case, quite a few people, had to be housed temporarily, and you mentioned about the fact that the casino's hotel was able to put them up here for the time being, what other kinds of services are available out there for their help if they need it, and especially now since they're going to have to be looking for someplace else to live?
Yeah, well, there, some community organizations made some shelters available. One in Gary, one in Hobart, where the families can stay. They're offering them food vouchers, medical assistance, help with getting prescriptions that might have been left behind, vouchers to help with bills that might need to be paid, utility bills. So there is help out there. Some of the families, are probably going to be able to move back, but some aren't because of how bad off their apartments are. And from talking to a lot of people, a lot of them sound like they didn't want to go back, like they would like to move anyways to get out of there. So, but there is help available for them.
Well, sounds like maybe another follow-up story, I'm sure, to come out of this as well, too. We're talking with Giles Bruce, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, about some healthcare news, as well as a sad situation of a fire at an apartment building in Gary that resulted in two young children dying from that. And Giles, as always, thank you for taking time to be with us today here on the program, and we'll check back with you again soon.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon.
Let's continue our Regionally Speaking Reporter Roundtable Thursday, and from the newsroom at the Times of Northwest Indiana, Carmen McCollum joins us. Hi, Carmen. How are you today?
Hi, Chris. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. Let's take a look here first at the information that you got from the Indiana Department of Education. We have 24 schools here in Northwest Indiana that are on the list of four-star schools for the 2016-2017 academic year, I understand.
Yes, there are 24 schools, and we've seen them on this list pretty regularly, pretty routinely. They do get on, they make it, and they always do it very well. These schools are good schools.
Mm-hmm. For folks that maybe are not aware about the designation, how does a school or a school district, for that matter, have a chance to get four-star schools on the list? What do they have to do?
Well, the ISTEF scores have to be good. The school grade has to be good. They have to be in the top 25th percentile of schools in the two ISTEF-based categories, and that would be for the ISTEP as well as the end-of-course assessment for high school students. Mm-hmm. They have to do well on both those tests, and the schools have to overall rate pretty well and be doing well. Most of these are A schools. None of them, I don't think any of them are a B. I'm not checking it specifically right now, but they're all highly rated schools.
Now, first, let's take a look at, I guess, some of the school districts actually have quite a few, and one in particular, the Crown Point Community School Corporation, has quite a few schools that are ranked as four stars, aren't they?
They do. They had Crown Point High School, Eisenhower, Jerry Ross, and Solon Robinson Elementary Schools in the Crown Point Community School Corporation. And that's three schools. That's pretty good. Yeah. One, two, three, four schools.
Wow.
Three elementaries and one high school.
You understand, Lake Central is another school district that has quite a few schools on the list.
Yes. Lake Central has George Bibich, James Watson, Coling, Pfeiffer, Critchfield, and Indian Trail Elementary Schools and the Lake Central School Corporation. There may be another list released in the next few weeks.
Oh.
And sometimes we get a second round of schools. Sometimes in the last couple of years, I believe they've done a first round and a second round of schools. So we may see even more from our area.
Now, how about the Valparaiso Community School District? How do they rank with so many schools this time?
Yeah, Valparaiso also did very well. Let me not leave out Munster. Munster High School was in the list. But in the Valparaiso area for Union Township School Corporation, Union Center Elementary School in Valparaiso was on the list. And Hayes Leonard Memorial, Northview, and Thomas Jefferson Elementary Schools in Valparaiso, the Valparaiso Community School Corp, and Valparaiso High School also made the list.
And it's nice to see, and I'm not sure how many often routinely show up as four-star schools on the list here, but the parochial schools in particular, the ones that are operated by the Diocese of Gary, as well as the Lutheran schools of Indiana, do you see many of these schools on the list? Which ones tend to be the ones that are on often?
Well, Emmanuel Lutheran School is in Valparaiso is also on the list. That's why I'm guessing there's going to be a second list released at some point, because there are some schools that repeatedly make it every year. They're not in this first list, but maybe in the second round.
I understand that this is what now the good grief, how many years have they been doing this? It's like, I'm just going to guess it's like about 30-some, 40-some, no, not quite 40, but about 20.
Not quite 40, but since 1988, when they first created the four-star school award, it's been, you know, schools have repeatedly been on the list, and it's good recognition for the schools. It lets parents and the communities know how the schools are doing, and it gives the school a chance to kind of brag on itself.
We're talking with Carmen McCollum of the Times of Northwest Indiana, looking at some education news and stories she covered for the newspaper this recent week. And another one I know that you picked up on with your byline in print as well as online deals with a school that Tommy Williams would have called Dear Old Roosevelt, but we know it's not the same Dear Old Roosevelt that he remembers anyway. Tell us how they've been doing here and how their students have been doing as well, too.
Well, let me say that Roosevelt is showing some progress. The students are showing some progress over at Gary Roosevelt College and Career Academy. Mm-hmm. I think when I went over there, what I was really interested in was the fact that they participated in this Technology Student Association competition March 9th in Terre Haute. They're only one of eight schools that participated. So they competed against seven other schools, and some of their groups did really, really well. I went over and watched them and watched the kids as they presented to me what they did for the for this competition, and they created this drone, and it was a bee drone. It was an interesting experiment. They wanted to look at why bees were having problems, why beehives were dying around the country. What was going on? Why was that happening? They put together a project, and their teacher, which is really interesting, she herself is a civil engineer, and she decided to go back to school after 6 years of being a civil engineer. She decided to go back to school and become a teacher, and she landed at Gary Roosevelt once she graduated. She's an excellent teacher in the classroom, and I think she's doing a really good job of transferring those engineering skills and activities and hands-on projects that the kids are doing in the classroom. Mm. So the kids were real excited to get involved in this TSA club that she started at Roosevelt. They're new. They've just been in the United States a couple of years. They've been in Indiana. They've been in the United States longer than that. They've been in Indiana a couple of years.
And we're talking about Jamie Wolverton, who is the civil engineer turned teacher. And you mentioned about the pollination project that they worked on. How did they get involved in a project involving bees?
Well, you know what? They looked at a variety of different things that they wanted to research. And the kids said they did a lot of work, and they spent almost a week trying to figure out what they do. And they have these TSA meetings after school. So what they did was just look at things that they thought would be interesting and that they thought would have a good effect in the competition, and something that they could really, really research and explain well themselves, and something that they got, something that they understood. So so when they when the students were explaining it to me, this one young lady whose name is, I believe, I know her last name is Martin. I think her first name is Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when she explained it to me, she was telling me about the work and the reason why the bees had been dying, and she talked about the problem with pesticides and the problem of the colony collapsing because some bees just leaving. The worker bees leaving the queen bee, and she explained it and told me how they wanted to try to understand that. So they created this little bitty drone, and it would fly around and buzz around the little plant that they had, mm-hmm. and they put everything on the poster board. It was really quite fascinating, and I mentioned to them that I was over at Discovery Charter School over in Porter, Indiana,
mm-hmm.
and they did a similar project, and in fact, they went a little bit further in that they actually started ordering bees and keeping them and watching them and trying to help the colony to not collapse and to continue and thrive. So it was a similar project. I thought it was just fascinating.
Well, it is. That's very interesting. We started out a conversation here when we talked about Roosevelt, about the fact that they are making improvements. They've had a tough route to take here, but they are on the way toward improvements. And I know that you spent some time talking with Superintendent Ernest Williams about this. And what good news did he tell you about the fact that they've made improvements?
One of the things he mentioned was with the 620 students in 7th through 12th grade and how they're working to try to bring in data to really concentrate on the data. So they've brought in data specialists who can help them to say, let's say that, and I'm just using an example, let's say that your reading scores for 8th grade are at 40%.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is really looking at all the data that tells them that and then pulling those kids out and trying to bring up their test scores and trying to work with them on if it's improving the reading, if it's bringing up a test score, if it's working on quizzes and making sure that they are concentrating at home and trying to work with parents. And I think that's really interesting that they're doing that. And the other thing that they're doing is offering a Saturday class.
Wow.
Not every school district does that, but they are doing a 2 to 3 hour Saturday class. And they started that, I think, maybe a couple of years ago. In addition, they're doing the same thing that schools across Northwest Indiana are doing, and they're offering credit recovery. So that means that, you can get online on the computer. Generally speaking, they do it in the classroom. But every now and then, they may have some students who can do some work at home and bring it in and get it all turned in online. And that's helping them to get all the credits that they need to graduate.
Well, Carmen, that sounds like great news to hear from Gary Roosevelt. And we appreciate you spending time with us today to talk about the stories that you cover. We've been talking with Carmen McCollum, who covers education for the Times of Northwest Indiana. We'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
It's time to talk water. Well, water infrastructure, that is. And the man we are talking to about that is one of the people who's worked so hard in the General Assembly over years and even up to as far as this past session of the General Assembly to deal with the issue of Indiana's aging water infrastructure. We're going to talk with State Senator Ed Charbonneau, who's a Republican from Valparaiso. Senator Charbonneau, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to chat with you.
Well, let's do a little primer first. It's been a while since people have really thought about this, unless they've had problems out there or they've complained about the lack of water in their neighborhood for some reason. Tell us overall about the major problem that the entire city of Indiana, and not just Northwest Indiana, faces with an aging infrastructure when it comes to water structure.
Yeah, Chris, and it isn't just Indiana. It's the entire country that is facing an infrastructure issue with regard to water. It's not unusual at all to find municipalities with pipes in the ground that are over 100 years old, pipes in the ground that are wood, kinds of things that are kind of unbelievable to think about, but having a very significant effect on health issues and just delivery of water, an issue that water is a scarce resource in many areas, and one of the issues you deal with when you talk about 100-year-old infrastructure is leaking pipes. And what we found over the years is that 25% of the water that comes into the system and gets treated is lost because of those leaking pipes. So it's a big issue.
Yeah. I know going back even to 2017, you were able in the General Assembly to get some major legislation passed and signed by Governor Eric Holcomb. Tell us about the measure that got through back in 2017, and then we'll look at what you had put into the hopper for this past legislative session.
Yeah, one of the big things was getting the Indiana Finance Authority to be the lead agency for the state of Indiana. And the key there, the Indiana Finance Authority deals with money and with federal money coming in, and they're able to multiply. When a small utility may have X number of dollars to invest in infrastructure, they can, with the use of federal funding, make that 3X or 4X, and a huge difference. And just a number of issues dealing with, again, with the infrastructure, with the IURC, and control of rates for in distressed utilities. There are big issues with regard to the ability of utilities to, let's say, expand out into areas where a community, let's say Valparaiso wants to grow, and how they can do that, yeah, and how they can pay for that.
I also understand, too, last year in the measure that went through and was signed into law was also a way to help get nearby states and other organizations involved in dealing with the issue if they hadn't addressed it already. This, I guess what it was referred to as a Trans-Border Water Resources Authority, and that sounds kind of confusing. What is that all about?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting one, Chris, because for many years, we're aware of the Great Lakes Compact that Indiana is a part of. And there was one representative in particular that was concerned about similar issues on the Ohio River, and thought that we should enter into a compact to deal with the Ohio River and any rivers and aquifers that join surrounding states.
Uh-huh.
And he'd been after that for about 5 years, and finally we did pass that in 2017.
And
it's very similar in effect to the Great Lakes Compact,
right,
but for other bodies of water.
And I understand that you were a sponsor in that measure. It was a House bill basically that got turned into law, but you were at least on the Senate version, you were the sponsor there too. So okay.
Yes.
So we take a look at what happened in 2017 in the General Assembly session. Let's take a look at 2018. Tell us, if you will, the bill that you had written and sponsored at the start of the session, Senate Bill 361. And I understand it would deal with what is being referred to as a Water Infrastructure Task Force.
Yes, we're now a good 6 years into dealing with water issues, and Chris, my approach from day one with this was that we were going to take steps that were very measured, and each step along the way would be based upon data and facts. Water is a very contentious issue. It's a very emotional issue when you start dealing with farmers and irrigation and maybe somebody wanting to say, hey, you're doing too much irrigating. Those kinds of issues can blow up quickly. We didn't want to do anything like that. And I think one measure of our success is the fact that over the 6 years that we have been working on water issues, I think every bill has passed every vote unanimously in both the Senate and the House. So that speaks volumes for, I think, a lot of work that a lot of folks have been doing and the collaboration that's been going on with regard to dealing with the water. Yeah. And the infrastructure now is okay, we know we have an issue. We know we have pipes in the ground that need to be replaced. The last IFA study, and we've commissioned IFA studies over the last 3 years, revealed that we had been grossly underestimating the need or the cost of updating our infrastructure, water infrastructure. And currently it looks like it's about $2.3 billion for starters, and then $850 million a year for the next 20 years. And the issue becomes, who's going to pay for that? The main issue right now. And it's very significantly different from road infrastructure, because road infrastructure is state or, you know, it's government property you can spend government money on. That's not the case with water utilities. You have municipal utilities, you have private utilities, you have utilities are under the jurisdiction of the IURC. Utilities are not under the jurisdiction of the IURC. You've got private utilities. So how you fund that becomes a very intricate, very complicated scenario. Mm-hmm. Now, and that's what the task force is going to take a look at.
Now, I understand the bill that deals with this Water Infrastructure Task Force did not make it through this legislative session. Maybe you know why, and if you do, please let us know. But there was an accompanying House bill that you mentioned that did make it through. Tell us about the drama that involved your bill making it through and what this House bill is about.
Well, you know, part of it is always timing, but yes, there were two bills, the bill that I filed and one that Representative Soliday filed in the House. And the normal process, we hear a bill in the Senate or the House, wherever it's filed, and then it goes over to the other body for another look and deal with. Both bills passed out of their House of Origin. Mine passed out of the Senate. The other, that's House Bill 1267, passed out of the House. When my bill went to the House chairman of the committee said he didn't have time to hear the bill.
Yeah.
So it in effect died. The bill that came over from the House, I was the House or the Senate sponsor of, made the changes to it. I didn't put it back to my original bill, but looked for some kind of middle of the road compromise. Sent that back to the House, and that bill ultimately passed.
Yeah. So you got one out of the two, at least, and there is something that to have said from this session. Now, are you going to bring up another version, perhaps, or a repeat of Senate Bill 361 in the next session?
No, there won't be any need for that.
Okay, because the other bill takes care of it. Okay.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay.
All right. So we're caught up here on what happened in the past in the legislature and this past session as well too, and I understand too. By the way, we're talking with State Senator Ed Charbonneau, a Republican from Valparaiso, about one of the major topics that he has dealt with for years in the legislature and the state and of the nation as well is our aging water infrastructure. You had an opportunity, I know, not long ago to participate in a Great Lakes Policy Workshop that was entitled "The State of Indiana's Water Infrastructure," a subject, of course, near and dear to your heart, certainly.
Yes.
We've just been talking about it, but tell us a little bit here about the people who participated in this workshop, along with yourself, and what all was discussed in that session.
Well, that was involvement from the, again, the surrounding states that surround the Great Lakes, a lot of common interest, and always are concerned. We have a number of organizations that continue to work on Great Lakes issues, and I'm also on the executive committee of a Great Lakes legislative caucus that meets a couple times a year dealing with these issues. Water is a huge factor for economic development. It is a huge factor. It is one of the top, if not the top, issue that companies, when they're coming into a state, and we have that experience in Indiana, that they're interested in knowing, tell us about your water availability.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I recall even hearing radio commercials from other communities and other states talk about the availability of water. And in fact, one commercial I recall had the sound of gushing water in the background. That's the idea, to let somebody out there who might be looking for a place to locate a business, let them know that this community has plenty of water to deal with, which is interesting because we know in the Chicago area, water is very scarce and it's very expensive and it's fought over quite literally. So it's interesting that these things could come up like that, to be sure.
Yeah. I forget who it was. One time said, "Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting." And
that's turned out to be prophetically true, hasn't it? It seems like I know. We're talking about water infrastructure and the problems, of course, with aging pipes and the mains and the like here, causing a lot of the problems with leakage. I know another problem too, that which is sad to say, is dealing with contamination, and part of that is, I know, with aging pipes. In this case, we're talking about lead contamination, and this led up, I guess, to a recent decision from Indiana American Water Company, which is one of Indiana's largest water utilities, if not the largest in the state, coming up with a plan that I know they have put up before state and federal regulators to deal with this problem. Tell us, if you're aware, of what this is all about and what do you think of it?
Yeah, I want to commend Indiana American Water for what they're doing. They're taking an issue that is in many respects complicated because Chris, what you have I talked earlier about the fact that you have different types of utilities and the same with the infrastructure. The Indian American owns their infrastructure up to the point where it comes off the main and heads into an individual's house. At that point, the individual is responsible for that. And you get into an area like we're involved in East Chicago, it becomes a real problem for individual homeowners to be able to pay to replace those pipes. So, and again, through some of the legislation that we did over the last couple of sessions, Indiana American now has the ability to go in and help replace those pipes. I mean, a huge health issue and a tremendous asset to have a utility that's willing to do that and then spread that cost out over all of their ratepayers. And that becomes an issue. Of course, and, me, if I live someplace 50 miles away, why am I paying for somebody in East Chicago's pipes, replacing their lead pipes? But it's the right thing to do, and hopefully the Indiana American has to go through there under the jurisdiction of the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission, so they have to get permission to do that, and that's the process that's going on right now.
In fact, I was wondering if it had gone through the IURC yet. The latest information I had that it was still under consideration by the commission.
Yes.
So the plan itself has not been approved as yet, and then they'll have to come back in again, of course, later, and it'll be a standard rate case then in how to deal with the costs that are going to come about with this plan, I would imagine.
Well, I think that what they're going through right now with the IURC is the rate case.
Uh-huh. So that's basically they have the plan, and apparently the IURC has signed off on the plan in basic terms. They just have to deal with the cost that the ratepayers are going to have, the customers actually are going to have to pay for the cost of having those lines replaced.
Yeah, and again, the value of that, Chris, is that we're talking about ratepayers all over the state of Indiana. Mm-hmm. That are come under the Indiana American.
Right. I wonder now too if this goes through and this plan is enacted fully and people are able to see the results of what Indiana American Water Company is doing here in the system. I wonder if we'll have other municipal water companies come across either similar plans or something very similar have to come up for a review by the customers at the very least, or maybe the regulators too.
You bring up another very interesting and kind of a twist to all of this, Chris, because most municipalities are not under the jurisdiction of the IURC.
Right.
Most municipalities can do this on their own. It's a matter of who's going to pay for it.
Yeah, I suppose it comes down to political will, I suppose, in this case, because then you have to talk to your customers, who basically are also the voters in the particular community too. It's all part and parcel of the process that you go through. It's no different than going up for re-election at the elections, such as the one coming up here in Indiana, to be sure. So this is a great way to close it out, I hope, Senator Charbonneau. Thank you very much for spending time with us today to talk about the issue of water, of aging water infrastructure, and how we've kind of gotten to where we are today, that there'll be more projects to work on, and I'm sure there'll be more things that will, I'm sure, in some way or another, come up again in the next legislative sessions, the ones in the future as well, too, to try and figure out ways to deal with the fact we have aging pipes and mains, and it means we lose water every single day. And we've been talking with the State Senator Ed Charbonneau, a Republican from Valparaiso, about this topic. And thank you very much for being with us to talk about today.
Thank you, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Michigan City Area Schools celebrated this week the addition of new solar arrays to its facilities in a ribbon-cutting ceremony that happened at Krieger Middle School. Barb Aggiano tells us more about it.
Michigan City Schools recently installed ground-mount solar arrays that feed into the NIPSCO power grid. The school corporation expects the new solar panels at 7 of its 16 facilities to offset utility costs by at least 52% per year. That's an annual savings of about $704,000. Dr. Barbara Eason-Watkins is the superintendent. She says the money generated from the solar arrays will support about $23 million worth of capital needs in the next 30 years.
And what we're excited about as well, even though we got initial financing to ensure that we could get the solar arrays, this is a project that will be self-funding.
The school corporation worked with the company Performance Services to install all 7 solar arrays before December 2017 to meet deadlines set by the state through a law that plans to phase out net metering by 2022. Because of the law, the Michigan City solar grids are currently set to only be operational for the next 30 years. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
Jerry Ross is a Crown Point native who's led an interesting life so far. He's a former astronaut and now an author. He's written 2 companion books that he signed at an event in Indianapolis. And we talked with him recently about his time in outer space and as an author of both adult and children's books.
I was fortunate to have a very strong family life. My parents were both Christians, and they brought me up in the Christian faith, and I don't think I would have ever had the chances to do what I did if I hadn't had that faith and support from the parents. I personally believe that God made me to be an astronaut. He intended for me to do that. From a very early age, when a lot of kids are thinking about wanting to be a fireman or a baseball player or something else, spaceflight captivated my imagination. And my mother helped me make scrapbooks about flying in space years before the first satellites were actually launched into space. And doing those scrapbooks, I learned a lot. I knew there was engineers and scientists that were doing that exciting work very early on in our space program. Mm-hmm. I knew that many of them had graduated from Purdue University. And so I was in the fourth grade when those first satellites were actually launched into space, and decided then and there in the fourth grade that I was going to go to Purdue University, become an engineer, and somehow get involved in our country's space program. Then as my education progressed and our space program expanded and we started flying people in space, eventually I thought that, well, if I'm going to be in a space program, the best place to be is on the pointy end of the rocket. And so I adjusted my goals, and eventually, through several false starts or bad turns or whatever, I eventually got to where I wanted to be.
Now, when you're doing your astronaut training and your other experiences there with NASA, you obviously came in contact with the other astronauts, people like Neil Armstrong in particular, who obviously must have had the same thoughts as a child that you had about wanting to go into space.
Yeah, well, I think Neil and Gus Grissom and that era of astronauts were even more removed from the space program initially, because there weren't even any thoughts about launching rockets into space when they were youngsters.
Yeah.
I think most of that era of astronauts were more of the flyer involvement. They wanted to be pilots. They wanted to fly planes.
Yeah, I guess a lot of them were were test pilots in the Air Force or test pilots in private business and supposed to, I guess, yeah. When you talk about in the book here about your faith, and you talk about idea that you've kind of gotten guidance from the Almighty to be involved in this, what things come to your mind, and especially the experiences that you have, all the space shuttle flights, the time that you spent on the International Space Station, what do you have a chance to take away from all of that? And thinking back, said, well, this is just another chance to get a little closer to God.
Well, actually, there was one incident on my third space shuttle flight. I was outside on the second spacewalk of that mission, and I was high above the payload bay of the space shuttle on the robotic arm and a foot restraint on the end of the robotic arm. It was nighttime, and the rest of the crew wanted to focus their attention on the other spacewalker out there, so they told me just to relax and enjoy it for a little bit. So I did. I turned off my helmet-mounted lights. I just kind of leaned back a little bit, and I was letting my eyes night adapt and to look at the universe just through a thin plexiglass helmet visor.
Right.
And as I did that, all of a sudden, I had this emotion or feeling come over me that I was at unity with the universe, that I was doing exactly what God had designed me to do, to use my brain and my hands to be outside to fix satellites and to build structures in space. And it was just one of those fleeting things that comes across your mind. I wasn't thinking about it or anything else. It just happened. But it was such a strong and reassuring feeling or sense that I had done exactly what God had designed me to do. I always look forward to having an opportunity to meet and sign books for people. The book, actually, and the children's version of it also, which is called Becoming a Spacewalker, are both written from my perspective and really trying to address my philosophy to young people. And that is that God made them for specific purposes. He gave them a unique set of likes and dislikes and talents and capabilities. And that makes them most suited for a certain type of work or involvement. And so I try to encourage them to figure out what that is or what those things are, and to figure out how they will use those in their adult life and career, and then to set goals for themselves and to study hard and to work hard to achieve those goals. And very importantly, don't give up too easily. Because throughout my book, I point out multiple times throughout my life and career where things didn't happen for me the way I expected them to the first time, and I had to back up and try a different route or do things a little bit better or a little bit harder the next time to ultimately be able to succeed and be selected as an astronaut and get a chance to fly in space.
That's former astronaut, now author, Jerry Ross. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, we'd also like to thank the folks who have been on Reporters Roundtable Thursday this week. That's Giles Bruce and Carmen McCollum from the Times of Northwest Indiana. On Monday's program, we have on tap a conversation with the Democratic Party candidates for Indiana Senate District 1 in the May 8th primary election. Hope you'll join us for that.